remember in elementary school of our teachers using the phrase, "All right, everybody put on your thinking caps." Well, tonight I'd like to reach back a little bit and ask you to pull out and put on your imagination caps. I want to do something that's a little bit different for myself as far as when I usually am up here. Tonight I'd like to just tell you a story. And it's going to require some imagination perhaps on your part. And so I hope that you will enjoy this time as we contemplate this story that I've simply entitled On His Own. The full moon overhead was the only light piercing the black night that shrouded the shores of the Jordan River. Earlier that day, scores of cattle, sheep, and people had traipsed through the waters, causing them to become clouded with sand and silt. But that was hours ago, and now the organized commotion was replaced with the calming flow of the clear waters. The entire world slept peacefully as the current trickled softly over the rocks. Well, almost everyone. In the distance, two figures can be seen grappling with one another, breaking the silence of the night. For hours, they have been locked in their match, each struggling to achieve and maintain position over the other. One is a stranger. His appearance was sudden, and his reason for being here is unknown. His name is even a mystery. The other is a wayward soul, returning to the homeland that he left as a young man. His name is Jacob. To the observer, the battle is almost over. The stranger, in a rather miraculous fashion, has rendered his opponent lame by dislocating his hip with a mere touch of his hand. But Jacob, whose name means heel grabber, is living up to that name. For even though he lies prostrate on his back, the crippled patriarch maintains a sort of death grip on the cloak of his rival. Yet no spectator witnessing such a well-fought match could even begin to perceive that this was not the real battle. No, the real battle is being fought deep within the heart of Jacob himself. For Jacob now speculates that the stranger is none other than God, who 20 years earlier had sworn a covenant of prosperity with him. But Jacob also knows that he is coming face to face with the consequences of a lifetime of self-sufficiency. And this hand-to-hand struggle with God will determine the path that he will walk for the rest of his life. You see, even from birth, Jacob had been a sort of scrapper. In the womb, he would struggle with his twin brother, so much so that their mother, Rebekah, inquired of the Lord a reason why. His response was simply, "You have two nations growing inside of your belly. They will be separated at birth, and one will be stronger than the other. The older will serve the younger." Perhaps it was this prophecy from God that endeared Jacob to his mother so much. Because from the moment he came forth from her womb, clasping the heel of his older brother, of his older twin Esau, he knew she liked him the best. And as Jacob grew into manhood, the countless retellings of that story while in the kitchen with Rebekah had awakened a sort of desire in his soul. You see, Jacob was no fool. If he was going to be greater than Esau, then he was going to have to change a few things. But how could he change the rules? You see, tradition demanded that as the oldest, Esau had the right to the greatest share of the inheritance. He was going to be richer than Jacob by default. Jacob couldn't challenge him for it. No, that wouldn't work, for his brother was a strong, rugged outdoorsman, while he was a soft-spoken, mild-mannered mother's boy. If he was going to fulfill God's expectations, then he would have to find some other more crafty way to do it. And then one day, opportunity knocked. Jacob had been hard at work brewing a pot of stew. And as the sweet aroma of the dish wafted from the tent, Esau stumbled into view. He was a wreck, hair and beard disheveled, his clothes soiled with sweat and dirt, today's kill being drug on a mat behind him. The man looked as though he were about to pass out. That's when he smelled the stew. His eyes glistened with want, and his stomach growled with desire. Jacob, he asked, would you give me a bowl of that stew? At first, Jacob thought nothing of it. He had fulfilled this request numerous times before. But just as he began to dip out a serving, a masterful idea jumped to the forefront of his mind. And with a sly grin, Jacob said, you may have some of this marvelous soup on one condition. Esau, rather incensed by his brother's stalling, snapped back, and what is that? Sell me your birthright. Well, at first, Esau didn't know what to say. Was a bowl of soup worth so much? And that's when his stomach reminded him of its current state. Empty. Jacob, I am about to die of starvation. What good is a birthright to me if I'm not here? Swear it over to me then, Jacob said. Fine. May God be witness that I give you my birthright. Now can I please have the bowl? And with a dip of the ladle, Jacob knew that he was on the path to greatness. Through wittiness and cleverness, he would make sure that his life expectations would be met. And he would do it all on his own. A few years later, Jacob found himself standing outside his father's tent. The sheepskin on his hands and his neck itched terribly. The woodsy smell of Esau's cloak mixed with the aroma of the roasted lamb that he carried was not exactly to his liking. His heart raced as he contemplated what he was about to do. He had told his mother that this was a bad idea. There is no way that he could make Isaac believe that he was Esau. Don't worry about it, she said. You're a smart young man. You will figure out what to say. You can do this. And as these words rang in his head, Jacob became more and more seduced by the thought of owning both the birthright and the blessing. And besides, if he got caught, Rebekah had promised to take all the blame. This was a win-win situation for him. Mustering up his courage, Jacob entered the tent. Who is it? Came the feeble voice of his father Isaac. It's me, Esau, your son. Puzzled, Isaac replied, but how is it that you've returned so quickly, my son? Well, because the Lord your God has blessed me in my hunting, father, he said with a wince. Approaching the blind, aged patriarch, Jacob was suddenly filled with fear. For as he knelt down, the wrinkled hands of his father reached out with amazing speed and grabbed him by the hand. He felt the hairy flesh and said, your voice is that of Jacob's, but the hands are of Esau's. Are you really my son Esau? Jacob swallowed. I am. Then bring me the game so that I may eat what you have prepared. As Jacob brought the food close, Isaac's grasp once again fell upon him, this time grabbing the cloak on his back and breathing deeply. The old man savored the smell of the outdoors coming from the fabric. Satisfied that the man in front of him was indeed Esau, Isaac ate and blessed Jacob with a blessing of prosperity, power, and protection. As Jacob prepared to leave the tent, a great sense of pride welled up inside of him. Against all odds, he had done it. He had deceived his father into believing that he was the oldest. And now the expectations of his life would be fulfilled because he had once again taken as his own what was rightfully his brother's. Oh, but the thrill of victory would be short-lived. For no sooner had he left Isaac's presence than Esau entered the tent. In a matter of minutes, a painful, agonizing cry emanated throughout the whole camp. And Jacob knew that he was in trouble. In fact, word circulated pretty quickly that Esau intended to kill Jacob as soon as their father was dead. And with that knowledge in mind, Jacob fled for his life to the Valley of Gerar, where his mother's relative Laban still lived. He would stay there for a few days. A few days. Until Esau's anger had subsided. 20 years later, we see Jacob standing by a water trough, whittling away at a pile of limbs. He's still in Gerar. For 2 decades, he has worked hard for his father-in-law, Laban. That two-timing, scheming, conniving old man, Laban. For 7 years, he worked his hands to the bone every day for the hand of Rachel, Laban's youngest daughter. That was the agreement. The wedding was beautiful. And as he went into the bride whom he loved so much, Jacob knew that his life was going exactly as he planned it would. Only the next morning he awoke to find that his new bride was not Rachel, but Leah, the weak-eyed older sister whom he did not love. In fury, Jacob stormed out to find Laban sitting at breakfast with a victorious smirk on his face. "What have you done?" demanded Jacob. "Our agreement was for Rachel, not Leah." "But Jacob," Laban replied, "don't you understand that tradition mandates that I must give the oldest in marriage before the youngest? Why does this surprise you so much? I'll tell you what. You finish this honeymoon period with Leah, and we shall renew our agreement. Work for me another 7 years, and you will be given Rachel." As Jacob stood whittling the branches, he still wasn't sure what he disliked most. Laban's attitude, or the fact that the whole situation was a case of the biter bitten. 7 more years of labor, and Jacob finally had the bride of his dreams. And in the 6 years since, he had been blessed with numerous sons. The problem was that he still depended on Laban for his survival. Well, not anymore. They had struck another agreement on Jacob's wages. All the speckled, spotted, and striped animals from the flock would be his. This time, however, he would pull the fast one on Laban. And with that thought, Jacob dipped the now striped tree branches into the water. He then herded up all the striped, spotted, and speckled from the flock and made them drink. "Give it time. Give it time," he thought. "And this will cause my flocks to grow strong and Laban's to grow weak." Well, perhaps the plan worked too well. For one day, Jacob overheard Laban's sons griping, "Jacob has ruined our father. He has taken away all of our inheritance and made it his own wealth." That complaint, coupled with the fact that Laban was wanting to change the wages for the 11th time, that was enough to convince Jacob that it was time to leave. So packing up all that he owned, Jacob and his family left in secrecy. They were headed back to the land Jacob had been promised on oath by God 20 years before. And coming to the Jordan River, Jacob knew there was only one thing that needed to be handled first: Esau. Sitting under the shade of his tent, Jacob was anxious to hear how Esau would reply to the news of his return. He thought to himself, surely after 20 years, he's forgotten about all that happened. He's forgotten about the whole birthright and the blessing thing. Just then the messengers came running up. Breathlessly they report, "Jacob, Esau, he received your message. He's coming here right now, and he has 400 soldiers with him. And they're coming here to meet you." At this news, Jacob feels his heart sink deep into his chest. Esau has not forgotten. And now he intends to finish what he vowed before their father's death. And for the first time in his life, Jacob has no idea what he is going to do. His deceptions have caught up to him. He can't return to Laban, for he had sworn an oath that he would never return. His parents are dead, so they cannot intercede for him. He has no army to fight against Esau. The only place he can look is upward. O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who said to me, "Return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. Lord, I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and faithfulness which you have shown me. I crossed this river Jordan with nothing but a staff. And now God, I have come back and I have become two companies. Deliver me, I beg you, from the hand of my brother Esau. I'm afraid, God. I'm afraid that he will come and attack me and my family. Protect me, Lord, because you promised that you would make me prosper." That night, Jacob would find himself locked in the greatest battle of his life. He fights against the God with whom he has been fighting his whole life. And as Jacob lies on his back, desperately holding to the cloak of this fleshly personage of God, he utters the words that the Lord has waited a lifetime to hear: "I will not let you go until you bless me. I cannot go another step. I cannot succeed if you are not on my side. I cannot do this on my own." And with that, the Lord relinquishes his grip. And he says, "What is your name?" He says, "My name is Jacob." And the Lord replies, "Now I will bless you. Your name will no longer be Jacob, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Until his dying day, Jacob is no longer the arrogant, conniving, deceitful man of his youth. Instead, he is the patriarch who understands the necessity of trusting in God and trusting in God alone for success in life. You see, God knew that Jacob needed to walk the path of self-sufficiency if he was ever going to trust him. The Lord left Jacob's deceitfulness unpunished for decades. Not as a means of going easy on him, not because he approved of the deceitfulness, but because he knew that Jacob would one day come face to face with the consequences of those choices. And when that day came, Jacob would have no choice but to look to the God of heaven for guidance. God had big plans for Jacob. God has big plans for each and every one of us here tonight. There are great things that he intends to accomplish in all of us. But in order to accomplish those things, we must trust him with all of our heart. The reality, though, is that we have all been like Jacob, in that we see the expectations for our lives and we think, "I can do this on my own. I don't need you, I don't need you, and I don't need you, and I don't need him. I can do this on my own." And we live that life turning a blind eye to God. We walk where we want to walk. We say what we want to say. And we will do whatever it takes to accomplish what we want to accomplish. But like Jacob as well, each of us will reach a point when our life's decisions leave us with nowhere to turn. Our self-sufficiency gives us no other path to go. Our skills will not be adequate enough to get us through. And it is at that point that we will find ourselves in a hand-to-hand struggle with God for the control of our own lives. And yet this fight is very much a paradox. Because the only way we can win this fight is to lose it. Jacob's victory was declared only when he finally admitted, "I can't go another step without God." Victory in our lives will only be declared when we get to the point that we say, "I cannot take another step without God."